Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio. Welcome to the show, Ridiculous Historians. Thank you so much for tuning in. It's your favorite Quentin Quarantino's back again. And, you know, my name is still Ben.
My name is Noel. Ben, I was not expecting that. That was good. What's a good another one? Like Quarantine Dogs?
Yeah, no. There we go. That's a good one.
That's not quite. Yours is way better. No, I got nothing. It's good to see you again. Your shining visage peering at me through my laptop screen.
Yeah, it's good to see you. Oh, you're Noel still.
I am Noel. And the way my windows are arrayed right now, you're very tiny. Let me make you bigger real quick. I want to really get a good look at you. We're using Skype today. There you are. And over there is super producer Casey Pegram in the right panel of my Skype window.
How about Inglorious Masquerades?
You're hired.
Very good.
I like it.
Very
hey,
good.
Once Upon a Time in Quarantine.
Oh my gosh, he's on fire.
I Quarantine say, land, quarantine wood, perhaps.
There we go.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
Fair enough.
We're working life here.
We'll work on these and send us your favorite Quentin Tarantino themed quarantine puns. In the meantime, Casey, I want to give you a shout out there in your window on the right side of my screen. You, sir, are a man of impeccable sartorial or fashion taste, and you have not let your game slip while we're in our exiles, because you have one of America's favorite t-shirts on right now.
That is true. I am wearing the podcast of the very podcast we are recording right now. I am the guy at the show wearing the shirt of the band, except I'm in the band, so that's even worse.
I, on the other hand, am full nude. Have been the whole time, guys.
Yeah, I had to minimize that window.
Okay, that's fair.
And I do want to point out for everybody who's thinking, is Casey wearing that Casey on the Case shirt with him as a child model? No, he didn't go that far.
No, he's just wearing the classic Ridiculous History tee, available now and always on tpublic.com/ridiculous history, I think. Is that how it goes?
Something like that. Something like that. We'll get the link up.
That'll get you in the neighborhood.
Yeah, that'll get you in the neighborhood. Today, we're going to talk about a classic all its own, a classic mystery. This may be a deep cut for some folks, but if you, like many of us, were a fan of those old paranormal or conspiratorial time life books like Mysteries of the Unknown, then you may have heard of these strange children, these literally green children. Now, Noel, I wanted to ask you, would you characterize this as a complete legend? Would you say there's probably something to it, or should we... Do you want to wait until the end of the show to make a claim or a judgment?
Oh my gosh, Ben, it's hard to even say whether it's any one of those things more than the other. It's kind of, more than any other story I've ever really dug into, a lot of all of them. And it's still hard to this day to decide which one it is more of, wouldn't you say?
Yeah. And we want to hear from you, fellow Ridiculous Historians. After we explore this, let us know what you think. I know we always say that, but this is something that we definitely want to hear more of, because this story, kind of like True Detective Season 1, like a much lighter version, this story skirts the supernatural without ever fully going supernatural. Here we are, the legend of the Green Children of Woolpit. It starts during the reign of a guy named King Stephen in a time in England's history in the mid-12th century called the Anarchy. Now, what do we know about Woolpit?
Well, we know a little bit about Woolpit. We know that it is an English town in England, obviously, and it comes from the Old English word for wolf pit. It is in Suffolk, and that is what it was named after, is these actual physical traps or pits that were used for catching wolves, because that was a thing at the time. Wolves, wild wolves roaming the heaths were kind of a problem. And they would not only kill like your livestock, you know, your sheep and whatnot, but they were known to come into villages and stuff at night and kill like, you know, sleeping children. Maybe I'm being alarmist here, but definitely a serious business. So there would be these pits that were dug into the ground, sometimes reinforced with stones, almost like a well, not quite as deep. And the wool, they'd be covered up sometimes with like, you know, straw or what have you to disguise them. And then the wolves would fall in.
Yeah.
That was the namesake of this town in Suffolk, which is the kind of main location of our tale.
Yeah. So this is fascinating. Now, I want to address the point that many of our listeners in the audience are already thinking of, which is this. Do wolves typically attack humans? The answer is no, but that's it. The answer is a no asterisk or a no but, because wolves will definitely attack humans if we're all collectively experiencing some form of privation during times of famine, and there's, you know, during times when these predators can't access other sources of nutrition, of course, if driven to desperation, they'll go for people and they'll go for livestock first. So a lot of those wolf catching pits, which, as you said, Noel, are a real thing, a lot of those wolf catching pits were for livestock, but wolves were known to attack people. The weird thing about Woolpit is that this was not really a middle of nowhere place. In the Middle Ages, the village of Woolpit was actually in one of the most agriculturally productive regions of the land, as well as one of the most densely populated areas. It belonged to the Abbey of Bury St. Edmunds, which was tremendously rich and powerful. What we've set the stage, this is where the story occurs, but we also want to tell you a little bit about how we know the story, because we don't have any firsthand evidence of this. It's cobbled together from a couple of different reports.
Yeah, that's right. One of them came from a person by the name of Ralph Coggeshall, and then another person by the name of William of Newburgh. And they were the two, we'll call them primary sources, that had accounts of this tale that were then stitched together by historians. Let me backtrack on that. It wasn't necessarily firsthand at all. They were anecdotal, but they are the only two people that we know about that were around to write about it. And there are some pretty wide swings about when this story took place. For example, one version might say that it took place during the reign of King Stephen. Another, and that was 1135 to 1154. Another might attribute it to happening during the reign of King Henry II, which was 1154 to 1189. And it was the kind of story that was very, very regional until around 1850, when Thomas Keightley put together a compendium called the Second Edition of Fairy Mythology that contained a telling of this story. And before that, it had really been something that you could only get in Latin tomes. In the 12th century, a book called Historia Rerum Anglicarum, and that was by Newburgh, and then Ralph Coggeshall's volume, Cornicon Anglicum.
Yeah. So this is also, by the way, the fun part of this is that both those guys, Willie and Ralph, it's William of Newburgh and Ralph of Coggeshall, they were in that period where your name would have an of in front of it. So it would be like Casey of Pegram, which I think sounds pretty classy. And I would love to bring that back, you know, Noel of Brown, Ben of Bolin, you know, it's got some panache, some gravitas. So as you said, yes, for a long time, this only came from those two 12th century sources. But after Thomas Keightley brought this out to the English speaking world in the 1800s, it was reprinted, it was adapted or embellished and put into all these anthologies of fairy tales and British folk tales. And it even got to the point where when you would read their version of regional guidebooks, it would also say like Woolpit, famous for the green children, and have a little paragraph about the legend. And this story, which I know we're telling you the story of the story, but we'll get to this actual story. This story took off because this story was, it was mimetic. People love to tell it. They love to hear it. And it was very difficult to prove or disprove. So we have to ask ourselves again, the question we were talking about at the top. Ultimately, we're on a mission to determine whether this story is a folktale or some embellished version of actual history. You know, like the way a grain of sand can get all this stuff layered onto it and make a pearl. We want to see if there's a grain of truthful sand in this fantastic story. But here we go. Once upon a time, maybe I'm biasing people here, but I like the way that story starts. Once upon a time, there were these two kids, a boy and his sister, and they're found at harvest time near some ditches that had been dug to, you guessed it, trap wolves at St. Mary's of the Wolf Pits, now known as Woolpit. And they were found by agricultural workers, reapers, like literally dudes swinging scythes back and forth.
But not like of the grim variety. These were like potentially upbeat reapers.
Yeah.
Although these were pretty tough times, you know, they might have been a little bit grim, but not harbingers of death itself.
Yes, yes, good point. Yeah. Reapers get a bad name in these are modern days. So imagine this. So these wolf trapping pits have been dug, and they're pretty deep because you don't want wolves to jump out of them. But these kids come out of one of these pits. And this is weird because the pits were probably twice as tall as the children. They were a couple hundred square feet in total area. So how did they get out? That's one weird question, but there was a much weirder question that needed to be addressed first, and that was the skin color of these kids.
Yeah, they had a certain greenish hue to their skin, which is, you know, it's already weird that they kind of emerged from these pits. Like, this story is already set up to be the stuff of legend, right? Like, there's no question about it. There's a lot of details that really lend themselves to, what's the word? Not alarmism, but embellishment, let's say, where you can really hop on, oh, they had green skin, and they came out of these, like, 10-foot-deep pits, and they were really spooky, and they came, took us by surprise, and were probably levitating. I don't know. That last part I made up. But, yeah. It's true. They had this greenish tinged skin. They were wearing odd looking clothes. They spoke in an unintelligible language, unintelligible at least to these Merry Reapers. Super strange little kids, creepy kids wandering up out of the clear blue sky, out of the deep, deep, dark wolf pits. And what's a Reaper to do when faced with a situation like this, Ben?
Well, they took them to the village and they said, you know, these are weird kids, but they're still definitely kids. They look human, so somebody help them out. And they took them to a local landowner, Sir Richard de Cane, at Wilkes. Now, Richard de Cane is the one who, for those of you keeping track at home, Richard de Cane is the guy who allegedly gave the information to our earlier people who write the books, those two guys. So Richard is allegedly the primary source, and he notices some weird stuff. First, their diet. The kids, you know, you're an adult, you see some kids wandering in the woods, you want to feed them, but these kids, despite looking famished and starving, they would not eat any of the food presented to them. And so the entire village is trying to go through their larders to find something the green kiddos will eat. And one of them eventually brings around some beans that had just been harvested, and the kids love them. What kind of beans, we may be wondering? Glad you asked. This is a point where the stories differ.
That's right.
One story says they're fava beans. Another one says, no, that's BS. They're green beans, and the kids didn't get them from the villagers. They just ate them straight out of the ground.
Well, wait, so that means that maybe this is a version of the story where they were kind of fending for themselves or like foraging, and maybe the kindly village folk had not found them yet, or what's the deal there?
It sounds like in this version of the story, it sounds like the kids, they tried to feed the kids and then they let the kids wander around and the kids foraged and only ate beans for months and months. And then they expanded their culinary horizons and eventually started eating bread. But it doesn't say how many months went by, and you got to wonder, how long can a person survive on beans, you know?
I mean, I like a bean. Don't get me wrong. It's a good staple food. But yeah, I see another version of the story too, where they specifically had a taste for raw beans that were freshly harvested as well. So it may have been that, you know, whatever the freshly picked crop was, that was what attracted the kids' eyes. And the fact that they were green beans, wonder if there's a little creative license in that telling of the story. It also makes me wonder, you know, you hear about a lot of fairy folk, we'll get to this, and, you know, supernatural creatures from this part of the country that were green, like the Green Man and a lot of, like, you know, woodland fairies that are green. I wonder if the Jolly Green Giant, you know, canned vegetables came from any of this lore. Kind of bet it did.
Oh, yeah, that's an interesting point. Yeah, because the Green Man, or the vegetable god, is an ancient belief. So I wouldn't be surprised if that kind of carries over into this story. That's an A-plus folklore reference there, man. So we know that Richard raises these kids, or he at least allows them to live with him, and he's the big guy in town because he's a landowner. He lets them live on his estate for several years, and slowly he tries to convert them to eating normal food. According to our earlier sources, the ones in Latin, this change in diet eventually led to them losing their green complexion. And also, let's bring in some modern science here. Research does show that people who eat large quantities of certain fruits and vegetables can show a change in skin color, but it's more toward a golden, healthy glow.
You know, this is actually true, and I say this from experience. I had a piano teacher when I was younger who had cancer, and she went a very holistic route in her treatment and was prescribed lots of high nutrient vegetables, and she ate lots of carrots and drank lots of carrot juice, and she actually developed kind of an orangish color. Like, and it's absolutely true.
Yeah, that can happen. It's called carotenemia, and it's apparently most notable on thick skin, like the soles of your feet, for example. It's caused by an excess of beta carotene in the blood. This is weird. There are a couple of other strange skin color stories we can get to, but with these folks, it was so long ago that we don't have the science, but it appears that the folklore is building or implying an argument that whatever these kids were eating before they showed up, it was somehow partially responsible for their green skin color. But they didn't adjust very easily, did they, Noel?
No, they really didn't, Ben. The girl proved to be a bit more resilient, but unfortunately the boy became sickened and for lack of a better term, depressed and kind of disenchanted, and he eventually did pass away due to this illness, maybe because of malnourishment. We don't really know, but thankfully his sister remained in pretty good health, and her skin returned to a normal shade and lost that green tinge, and that is when she began to pick up English, because you'll recall that we mentioned that both of them spoke what to the villagers that found them was gobbledygook and some kind of like alien tongue, right? And so she eventually started picking up after, you know, she was taken in by this household, and she started telling some stories, didn't she?
Yes. Here is our second once upon a time. You're right, Noel. As this kid learns to speak English, she becomes increasingly articulate, and she starts to tell the villagers and tell Richard, the landowner, the story of her origin. This was called St. Martin's Land. At least that's what it's called now. And in St. Martin's Land, according to this girl, everything and everyone was green. It was always twilight. According to her, this boy who had recently passed away was, in fact, her brother. Now, here's where the stories differ. We're going to do our best to give you the multiple versions or differences. In one version, she says that she and her brother had been herding livestock for her father, and they heard a loud noise, and they found themselves suddenly at the bottom of this wolf pit. But then there's another report that's a little different, right?
Yeah, there are, like I said, that this is one of those things that you have to take with a grain of salt, because not only were the sources that we know of not firsthand, it's been passed down and really treated like the stuff of lore. So it really is the kind of thing where it's really hard to say where the truth ends and the fiction begins and vice versa. So yeah, yet another version of the story has the children being transported from their homeland, St. Martin's Land, to the field where they were found, or to the wolf pit rather, when they hear the sound of bells. And they're transported to this cave. When they come out, they realize that they're in Woolpit and not good old St. Martin's Land. And that they, you know, the blinding lights, you know, kind of like hits their eyes, and they realize we're not in Kansas anymore, because they had apparently, according to this version, wandered in darkness for quite some time. Not to mention, there's a part that's consistent in several of these stories that the girl tells her host family that St. Martin's Land, where they come from, is a land of permanent twilight.
Right, yeah. As I had mentioned before, this was one of the details that was consistent, along with her statement that everyone and everything in St. Martin's Land was green. So there we go. We can already also see some familiar folklore tropes, like the old Joseph Campbell thing, the cave you fear to enter holds the treasure you seek. There's a lot of powerful symbolic stuff going on here. Back to Ralph and Willie, their stories differ in some notable ways. William says that this girl called her home St. Martin's Land, and he says that she said, see, we're playing the telephone game already. He says that she said everyone there venerated and worshipped the saint, St. Martin. And this is interesting because St. Martin was known to the surface world. I'm planting a seed there. St. Martin was known in Western monasticism. He had a November feast day. He had a harvest festival in particular. And his festival was comparable to Halloween. And William said that inhabitants could see, even though they were in a twilight realm, they could see a bright land over a great river. William's story also cuts out the cavern and just says that the kids literally heard the bells and then woke up in the wolf pit. Oh, we should mention that Richard, by the way, was a little out of order, but we'd be remiss if we didn't note one of the first things that Richard did when the kids were under his care, he took them to be baptized.
Of course he did.
It's kind of like medical care, right?
For
them at that time.
Yes, that's probably right. They think it's going to inoculate them against the forces of evil or whatever. I don't know. The reason I about it is that, like, they don't know anything about these children's heritage or where they come from or what their faith might be. It's just very presumptuous is all I'm saying, I guess, right?
Right, which also makes you wonder how much of the narrative has been twisted to meet religious expectations of the time. Because they're in what appears to be a subterranean realm that already has maybe not knowledge of Catholic dogma, but they all know one saint in particular. That's odd.
Yeah, that is really weird, right? They know of one saint. That we're going to get into kind of the unraveling of this story, but you got to wonder too if, like, you know, was there concern that these were somehow like demons from the fiery pits of hell? You know, they come from a pit. At the very most, a subterranean realm. I don't know. If I was a truly, truly God-fearing man, like this gentleman likely was, that might give me pause. I'd be like, get thee to a baptisery, you know, post-haste.
Or an exorcism mart, or whatever they called them, right?
Surely they had those then.
Yeah.
They were just farmers markets. They were just like, you know, there was just a stall at the farmers market. Next to the produce, you've got like a priest who can exorcise your demons. Maybe even exorcise your vegetables before you take them home with you.
It's a drive-through too, or a trot-through, so you can take your horse if you're in a hurry. And, you know, you don't have to get out of the saddle. That's the one you want to look for in the mart. So there you have it. Now the next question. So the young boy has died, but what happened to the mysterious green girl? According to the story, which I know we've been saying a lot in this episode, according to the stories, the Green Girl eventually assimilates into society. She's baptized. There are rumors that she later marries someone in an adjacent county, Norfolk, near Suffolk, who may have been high up in the government all the time, although there are some other reports that I would say are way less verifiable, although none of this is verifiable. There are conflicting reports that, you know, really showcase the misogyny of the day and say she became, quote, rather loose and wanton in her conduct.
I'm sorry, loose and wanton? Mm-hmm. Is that like referencing her sexual proclivities, perhaps?
Right, that's what they're saying, yeah.
Ugh.
They're saying she grew up and got around. Yeah. And that,
again, my groan is not for her. My groan is for the judginess of these people.
Right, right. Again, yeah, like I said, the misogyny of the time. She may have taken the name Agnes Barre, B-A-R-R-E, but there's no definitive evidence. We know one report of the guy she married. He's an archdeacon, I think.
Yeah, that's right. Archdeacon of Ely, a man by the name of Richard Barre. And according to one account, they had at least one child.
What color was the kid?
Unclear.
Unclear.
Yeah, well, that just means opaque.
There we go.
Okay. Yeah, because, you know, let's get into this. So that's a really good segue, Ben. Why were they green in the first place?
Yeah, so if, and this is a big, big IF, if the story is based on something that was true, there are a couple of plausible explanations behind this greenish hue. One theory is arsenic poisoning, because you know, arsenic has been used to create green dyes in the past, and if you are exposed to it, it can give your skin this green dotted rash. But the weird thing is, if we think it through, at this time in history, in England, if you found some kids you didn't know and they had something that looked like a disease, you would be way less likely to do the Christian thing and help them out, because you wouldn't want to expose your own community to things that could literally kill everyone you love within a matter of weeks or months. You know, leprosy, measles, smallpox, all the hits, all the terrible, grim, and grisly hits.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, gosh, it really puts into perspective what we're dealing with right now. I mean, like, I've had this bit of a cold and it turned into some bronchitis for going on 3 weeks now. And as this, you know, coronavirus situation hit in, just having a bit of a cough really started to turn some heads, just in terms of like suspicion towards me as a human being walking around. So at this time, when, I mean, there were so many potentially absolutely obliterating diseases, like you mentioned, there would certainly be some suspicion, right? And it makes you really, gives you pause as to why they would have just taken in these oddly colored children with such open arms if they even caught a whiff that there might be something wrong with their health.
Absolutely. And there may have been something wrong with their health, because remember, one piece of evidence we have is that their skin color changed when their diet changed, right? We have a couple of other theories that might explain their green coloring. What was it called? Chlorosis? Kind of like chlorophyll or something? I'm not sure.
Yes, it comes from the Greek word chloris, which refers to a greenish yellow color. And this is something that has been, this is a funny part of the story here, that has been observed for centuries past. There's a German doctor by the name of Johannes Lange, who in the 16th century referred to this disease as something called a disease of virgins. And he said the remedy was to go have you some sex. Yeah. That'll knock it right out. And now, you know, and yeah, it is now in the 20th century. We now realize that it has more to do with malnourishment and should be treated with iron supplements, sort of like scurvy, which is a lack of vitamin C. But I'm thinking of when you're jaundiced and you have a yellow complexion to your skin, doesn't that also have something to do with malnourishment, or what is that as a result of? Am I completely misconstruing that?
Yeah, so jaundice can have a couple of different causes. It turns you yellow because you have a high level of this stuff called bilirubin, which is a bile pigment. It can come from hepatitis, come from gallstones, tumors. It's pretty gross. Yeah, I mean, it's a rough thing to have, but you're right. It can also come from diet. So first off, I want to say Dr. Lang calling this a disease of virgins and prescribing sex as a cure sounds troubling, because it sounds like he might have been writing that to a specific patient. You know what I mean? Pretty gross. Totally. Yeah.
Yeah.
So there we go. There is some science, and we know that there are a couple of different ways in which people, through privation, can turn green, or their skin color can noticeably, visibly change. But our next question is, okay, cut past the legends, cut past the endlessly fascinating folklore, who were these children, assuming they are real, and where did they really come from? Here is where one publication that I always loved, Fortean Studies, comes into play through an author named Paul Harris.
Indeed. Harris suggested in a book he wrote called Fortean Studies 4 from 1998 that the children could have been Flemish refugees who were absolutely persecuted in these days. And then they would have come from a nearby town or village called Forum St. Martin. Does that ring a bell? St. Martin. And that would have been separated by a quite substantial river from Woolpit, the River Lark. And remember that part of the story about being able to see a bright shining light across a formidable river? A lot of these Flemish, there's an excellent article on ancientorigins.net that really digs into some of the different potential explanations behind this phenomenon of the green children of Woolpit. And one of them is this tale that goes into the history of the Flemish persecution under King Henry II. In 1173, many of them were killed in a place near St. Edmunds in the Battle of Forum. And many of the folks who survived this massacre, really was an absolute bloodbath, fled into the forest, Thetford Forest to be specific. And what would be an area that feels like perma-twilight, Ben?
Right, the forest.
Yeah.
So here's the thing, though. This brings up two important points. First, ancientorigins.net is, this account is good for the legend or speculative aspects. There's not a lot of science there. So if you are working on a report for school, be sure to note that when you're using it as a source. Second question, how old were the children specifically? Other than that the boy appeared to be younger than the sister, we don't have a specific age for them. So if you are a very young child, then of course Thetford Forest may have seemed like permanent twilight. It's an old growth forest. Secondly, you know, maybe your parents, fearing war, would have taken you, told you to herd livestock and acted like everything was okay when they were just trying to get you away from the conflict. It's also true that because the Abbey of Bury St. Edmunds was established and wealthy, they had the ability to ring loud bells. So loud bells often chimed. You could probably hear them over the river. But it's possible, and this comes from a Mental Floss article, it's possible that the children had been orphaned in the conflict, had been foraging on something that gave them a poor diet, led to malnutrition and green skin, and eventually made their way to Woolpit by following the sound of the bells. And so then, like, that actually sounds plausible, doesn't it? It doesn't have all the secret conspiratorial supernatural elements. It sounds like hazard of war.
100%. And, you know, we're gonna raise the bar one more rung on some of the conspiratorial angles in just a second. But to me, this one very much is the tragically most realistic scenario, as that these were children who were disoriented, not to mention the fact that a lot of the folks in these different Flemish villages would have had their own very specific dialects that would have been completely unintelligible to outsiders, you know, in the same way we have communities like the Irish travelers in Augusta, Georgia, Edgefield area, for example, where they speak a very specific form of Gaelic, you know, that's very alien to even, you know, Gaelic speakers.
Right, right. This is an interesting point, because what does unintelligible mean? We have to remember that people were far less likely to have intense significant interactions with folks speaking a different language. They were also far less likely to be literate, and they were far less likely to just recognize something, even if they didn't understand it. So all bets are off there. This is a time when a lot of people lived and died within mere miles of where they were born. So let's look at an historian named Derek Brewer in his book, The Color Green, also in 1998. So note that this was a resurgence in the story. Derek Brewer argues that the likely core of the matter is that these very small children herding or following flocks strayed from their village, didn't speak very much. Maybe they were so young. And the way we would put it in modern times is they didn't know their home address, and they weren't like the kids in the movies who have a note pinned to them that says, hey, my house is, you know,
right,
123 Woolpit Street.
Or one of those tags. Remember, they used to be like special tags that kids would have on their backpacks, you know, almost like that was a thing back in the day. I don't think it's so much. Well, nowadays kids have like, you know, phones and stuff, and you can just like geolocate them. But they would have just kind of been lost in the wild, and depending on the kindness of strangers. And thankfully they did get a little bit of help. But yeah, it's true. It was really just this version of the story is also pretty sad.
Brewer, by the way, also is a proponent of the chlorosis deficiency theory. So there we have it. There we have the plausible explanation for the green children, but let's get weird with it. Let's look into, just briefly, let's look into all the crazy stuff, because that's the exciting stuff, right? So now don your tinfoil hats with us, or aluminum foil, I guess. Let's look at Robert Burton, who in 1621, in his book, The Anatomy of Melancholy, suggests that the green children, quote, fell from heaven. This is true. This author did say this back in 1621, and it set the stage for later independent researchers or authors or whatever you want to call them to say, hey, what if these kids were aliens?
Yeah, this guy named Duncan Lonan, in an article published in Analog magazine in the late 90s, he hypothesized, we'll use that term loosely here, I guess it's appropriate, that they could have accidentally been teleported or transported in some way from their home planet to Woolpit. And he conjectured that their home planet may have been trapped in some sort of synchronous orbit around the sun, and that it would have been a planet that had similar conditions that would have allowed life, and also had a kind of sweet spot between having an inhabitably hot surface and a frozen dark side, such as the dark side of the moon.
Yeah. Dark side of the moon. That's a good comparison. It made me think the author might have been implying Mercury as an origin point. Interestingly enough, scientists discovered a few decades back that there is actually water ice on Mercury deep in these craters, and we're still figuring out how it formed. So Mercury would be an interesting answer, but notice that Duncan Lunan kind of skips over the part where they got from wherever their extraterrestrial origin point was to Woolpit, England. We have to say one other thing. This is, I think, one of the more fun fantastical elements. The green children, it has so many tropes about the unseely, as they might be called in Gaelic or Irish culture, or the fair folk? What if these were elves or fae from some other dimension, the land of the fairy? It's weird because interpreting the story this way really hits on little specifics that sound kind of added into the story. Like, you know, in fairy mythology, fairies never eat mortal food.
Yeah, that's even like a thing in Pan's Labyrinth, for example, where the heroine is presented with that table of food, and she's warned never to eat it, and she eats it, and it's like considered to be a terrible taboo because her little fairy companions are really freaked out by this whole thing. Not quite the same, but yeah, no, it's true. Like, it's almost like there's various versions of that trope where, like, if the fairies eat human food, it could kill them, or it could render them powerless, or they could lose their fairy abilities, or what have you. So it's almost as though these were, that's why they rejected the human food. Except, you know, I don't know. Like, if it's beans, though, like, that's grown from the ground. I mean, that seems pretty fairy friendly to me. Doesn't it? I don't know.
In a lot of tropes, fairies or the fae don't actually eat meat. They have practice a vegetarian or what we call a vegan diet. It's interesting, too. Two things it makes me think of, just as an armchair folklorist here, the fae also traditionally fear instruments of iron. They're iron averse, but iron supplements fix chlorosis. It has nothing to do with anything.
I think you're onto something here.
Of the Charlie Day meme right now. You know, yeah, where I'm lining up stuff on the board.
Do you think your aversion to handling metal potentially points that you may have some fairy blood in you?
I don't know, man, because I eat meat, you know.
That's true. Okay,
yeah,
maybe you're just half fairy.
Just half fae, you know. I'd be okay with that. Everybody needs a little supernatural in their lives. Right now, though, Noel, Casey, as you guys know, this story has largely been dismissed as an entirely fabricated tale of folklore. And that brings us to the question we started at the top. So my friends, I want to give you all the honor. What do you think? Do you think complete fabrication? Do you think troublingly plausible? Or do you think maybe grain of truth embellished over centuries?
I mean, like I said, the version of the story where they were Flemish refugees that were kind of expelled in fear of their lives to live in another kind of more wooded area that they call St. Martin's Land. It makes sense. That sounds like the way a child would describe something during a time of trauma, you know. Mm-hmm. and all they could say was St. Martin's Land, and it was always twilight. They were just describing it in terms they could understand, you know, and having to process, like, losing their parents, losing their way of life. I mean, you know, and we also don't know exactly how old they were. It doesn't seem like they were, like, babies. I mean, if they were helping tend flock, they probably would have been maybe minimum 7-8 years old, you know, maybe more like 10-11, right? So they would have had a very real understanding for the most part of what was happening to them, but it would have been so painful and traumatic that they might have had to process it differently. Not to mention that they're malnourished and, you know, kind of wandering around in a time where it was not very safe to do so.
Yeah, and the fact that we know the male child was younger means it may have been a situation where the parents sent the girl to look after the livestock, but also watch your little brother. That's something that a lot of our fellow listeners who grew up with siblings will doubtlessly be familiar with.
And thankfully, we do have it as the inspiration for a lot of fiction, poetry, you know, these kind of fairy tropes. And it is, you know, Ben and I, In hosting Stuff They Don't Want You to Know, we run into stories all the time like this, where there's usually a very plausible explanation, but it's the implausible versions of the story that cause it to proliferate and spread like wildfire, because that's what captures people's imagination, not the sad tale of two wandering orphans, you know, that fall into a wolf pit. It's the version of it that, like, they're somehow supernatural beings from a subterranean land that, you know, or from another planet that really gets people thinking. And the fact that there's so many varying versions of this story just adds to that.
Yeah, agreed. And this is where the story draws to a close. We want to hear from you. Let us know where you fall. Do you believe that this was some sort of supernatural encounter? Do you, like Casey, Noel, and myself, think that this is more a, as I said earlier, a game of telephone over the centuries, but, you know, ultimately the story of war, refugees? And maybe, most importantly, do you have any other stories from folklore that you think have a grain of possible truth to them? If so, we'd love to hear them. You can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Instagram. You can find us on Twitter, not just as a show, but as individual people.
Yeah, you can find me exclusively on Instagram. It's a lot of memes that I'm posting and a lot of just, you know, I've been playing a little bit of guitar again. I might post some Instagram stories of my nerdy guitar synth setup, making some ambient music to calm me down in this time of uncertainty and chaos. And you can find all that stuff from me at How Now Noel Brown on Instagram. And let us know what your hobbies are, what things that are keeping you from kind of going crazy are right now during this time. You can send those as an email to us at ridiculous@iheartradio.com.
Yeah, and you can also find our Facebook community page, Ridiculous Historians, for sharing your stories with our favorite part of the show, your fellow listeners. As an individual, you can find me at Ben Bolin on Instagram. You can find me at Twitter at Ben Bolin HSW. On a personal note, one thing that I'm doing on Twitter right now is fielding questions about prepping, about survival, about hygiene. Love in the time of coronavirus. So if there's something that you want to know about, if I don't have the answer, I will work ardently to find it for you. So don't hesitate to hit me up on Twitter or Instagram. And as always, before we go, we want to give a big thank you to our super producer, the best dressed man on the Skype call. That's Mr. Casey Pegram. And we'd also like to thank Alex Williams, who made this banging track you hear at the beginning and the end.
Huge thanks to Gabe Luzier for being our research associate extraordinaire, Christopher Hasiotis here in spirit, Eve's Jeffcoat. Check out This Day in History class, produced by our pal Chandler Mays.
And thanks to you, Noel. Thanks to you, specifically you, for tuning in. We hope that you are happy, healthy, safe, and not turning green.
See you next time, folks. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.